Ladies and gentlemen, welcome everybody. If you could just take your seats and we'll start any second now. Well, once again, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name is Amanda Drury. I'm from CNBC and I'm going to be your moderator for the event today. I would like to welcome you all to the launch of the new Climate Economy Report, Better Growth, Better Climate. And naturally, like the title, the purpose is to help governments, businesses, society all make better decisions on how to achieve economic prosperity while at the same time addressing climate change and not compromising the environment. So this isn't just any report. It is the flagship report of the Global Commission on the Economy and the Climate. It's been chaired by the former president of Mexico, who is here today and is going to be on our panel. President Felipe Calderon, it's a real pleasure to have you with us, sir. And it's also launched today in the presence of the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. It's a real honour to have you as well with us today, sir. And we really thank him very much for his visionary leadership in tackling the global challenges that we're seeing in our time. Indeed, particularly mobilising world leaders, making sure that everybody responds to climate change in a timely manner. So, first of all, what is the Global Commission? So it includes former heads of government, includes finance ministers, and includes lots of leaders in the fields of businesses and economics. It's also truly global because this has been the undertaking of seven sponsor countries. Let me just name them for you. They include Colombia, Ethiopia, Indonesia, Norway, Sweden, South Korea, and the United Kingdom. But of course, all of this doesn't just come together and happen all by itself. We do need some people to lead these projects. So someone else I would like to thank today is the Global Program Director, Jeremy Oppenheim. Thank you for being here today, sir. And Jeremy is going to be speaking very shortly. You'll be hearing from him too. I would also like to thank the Commission's eight partner research institutes. They include the Climate Policy Initiative in the United States, the Ethiopian Development and Research Institute, the Indian Center for Research on Economic Relations, the Global Green Growth Institute in South Korea, the London School of Economics, obviously in the UK, the Stockholm Environment Institute in Sweden, the Tsinghua University in China, and the World Resource Institute, which has served as the managing partner throughout this whole process. There was also a lot of input from various areas. The project has benefited greatly from an advisory panel, and this advisory panel was made up of world-leading economists. And it was chaired by Lord Nicholas Stern, who has provided an expert review of the report. So we're going to be hearing from Nick any moment now as well. But now I would like to hand it over to President Calderon, who during his presidency established himself and Mexico as a global leader in this department, in fighting climate change. His day-to-day support of this project as well has been absolutely invaluable. So let me hand it over now to President Calderon. Sir.
Thank you, Amanda. Mr. Secretary General, thank you very much for being here and for your kind hospitality, especially in these difficult days for you and for the international community you are leading. Thank you to be here. Members of the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to the launch event of Better Growth, Better Climate, the new Climate Economy Report. Thank you all for being here in such an important event. I would like to start by expressing my deep gratitude to the leaders of Colombia, Ethiopia, Indonesia, Norway, South Korea, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. Their vision and leadership have been crucial to make this independent report possible. Thank you very much for all your support during this process. Let me also thank all my fellow commissioners, in particular, Professor Lord Nicholas Stern, the co-chair of the commissions and the leader of the economic team. And of course, thank you, Jeremy Oppenheim, for your incredible commitment, and to all the team whose great effort is reflected in this important report. I believe we assembled a great collection of experts and professionals, and the results show it. Climate change is real and strongly backed by science. The recent IPCC report has shown, with strong scientific evidence, that climate change and global warming are a reality. The report confirms that global warming is highly correlated with the emission of greenhouse gases coming from the human activity. In the last century, land and sea temperatures, as well as the sea level, are all rising. The last three decades have been the hottest in history, one after the other, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. In brief, IPCC and science has rested its case. Climate change is real, and it's a growing threat to humankind. Right now, tens of thousands of people are suffering from the devastating consequences of a hurricane that hit Los Cabos in my country, Mexico, last night. I don't want to say that this event is a direct consequence of climate change, but at least it's the kind of events we will see more violent and more frequent in the future if we don't act today. So with such clear evidence, the solution should appear obvious. We need to reduce our carbon emissions. But if the evidence is so clear, why haven't we acted? Why have government and business leaders done so little to reduce climate risk? The real problem, in our opinion, is that there is a widespread perception that taking action on climate implies huge economic costs. Therefore, there is a common belief that we have to choose between economic growth or mitigating climate risk. Over the course of this and next year, countries around the world will be working out how much action they can and should take to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. However, at the same time, many countries are also recovering from the worst economic crisis since the 1930s and are rightly focused on achieving sustained prosperity and reducing inequality. The question they face is whether they can simultaneously address both of these challenges. Answering this question was precisely the mandate for the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. So 1 year ago, we set out with the best and brightest minds to answer it. We conducted one of the most comprehensive economic analyses ever done on this subject. More than 100 institutions worldwide contributed, and now, after a year of hard work, we have reached a clear conclusion. Yes, it is possible to have better growth and better climate. Yes, it is possible to create jobs and reduce poverty, and at the same time, reduce the carbon emissions that threaten our future. Yes, it is possible. But we need to make some fundamental changes and smart choices. We looked for real-world evidence and concluded that major structural and technological changes in the global economy are now making it possible to achieve lower carbon emissions and better economic growth at the same time. And the transition to a low-carbon economy can improve the quality of growth, including the creation of new jobs, cleaner air, and better health. A growing number of businesses, cities, and countries are showing us it is indeed possible. Our report concludes that we must focus on three key systems: energy, cities, and land use. We estimate that these three sectors will require investments of around $90 trillion during the next 15 years. This scale of investment is itself a huge opportunity to change the future. How we choose to invest these resources will determine if we get locked in to a carbon-intensive future, or we are able to jump into a low-carbon path. The choice is ours. In other words, if we are going to invest $90 trillion one way or another, let's do it in the right way. Let's invest in low-carbon infrastructure instead of a current carbon-intensive one. First, in terms of energy, our report estimates that from now until 2030, energy demands could grow by a third. This growing demand results from improving living conditions and economic development around the world, which are both much needed. And we are not suggesting that we must decouple economic growth from energy demand. What we are saying is that we must decouple economic growth from carbon emissions. To do this, we must change the way we produce energy and the way we consume it. In terms of energy use, we have found that there are many measures that are not only good for the environment, but also have obvious economic and social benefits. Many of these measures are related to energy efficiency, and they are what we call the no-regret measures. They are the actions that allow us to reduce carbon emissions and at saving energy, and at the same time allow us to decrease costs for consumers and producers. We must put in place all these measures that generate economic savings and reduce emissions, but that is not enough. We need to provide energy for more than 1 billion people, the poorest families in the world, that still do not have electricity. And we must do it while at the same time avoiding the current path that is expensive and highly polluting. In that sense, our report coincides broadly with the Clean Energy for All initiative of the United Nations. And beyond that, we also need to take bolder, more difficult steps. Today, we are giving $600 billion in subsidies for fossil fuels, but only $100 billion in support for clean energy every year. So we are paying to pollute. That cannot continue. Our report, Better Growth, Better Climate, also concludes that phasing out the use of coal and replacing it with cleaner sources of energy is crucial to achieve our goals. Second, in terms of our cities, the report estimates that by 2030, 1 billion additional people will live in urban areas. That is equivalent of building one city the size of Washington, D.C., Berlin, or Singapore every single month during the next 15 years. The current model of sprawling cities with low density and more oriented to individual vehicles is no longer viable. We need another model, one that is based on mass transport system and more human proximity. We know that this implies tremendous effort to change public policies, but rapid urbanization also creates opportunities, and several communities and cities in the world are showing us the path. Even in this city, the Big Apple, authorities have been able to promote order economic growth and at the same time to reduce carbon emissions. And finally, in terms of land use, our agricultural and forest systems are coming under enormous pressure because of increased incomes, urbanizations, and rapid population growth. By 2030, we will need to feed over 8 billion people and feed them in a better way. We have to make better use of our land by improving agricultural productivity while protecting and restoring natural environments. We need to create and finance a new green revolution that allow us to satisfy the growing demand for food while avoiding the destruction of natural habitats, especially our rainforests. Previous studies, such as the Stern Report, had already concluded that waiting is much more expensive than taking action now, that the cost of inaction is much bigger than the cost of action. And you could ask, what has changed since those reports were published? Well, several things. First, During the past few years, we have seen technological revolution that has changed the economics of a low carbon transitions and provides huge opportunities for growth. In terms of clean energy, for instance, the cost of solar cells has fallen 90% and now make more economic sense. Second, we now have a series of great examples of successful policies that are working around the world. We can build on this and adapt policies to specific needs. Third, key actors around the world are beginning to take inspiring steps in the right direction. Finally, I believe new generations are much more conscious about this problem and are starting to push decision takers to act right now. The window to take action is closing fast, but at the same time, technological changes, the power of innovation, and increased awareness about the problem are providing us better chances than ever before. We have now more reasons to say this is the time to act. However, game-changing action requires clear decisions and brave public policies by all actors. We can unlock investment and innovation in a low-carbon economy if we provide the clear signals to the market. That requires that governments put the right public policies in place and provide clear market signals as prices to businesses and investors so they choose low carbon paths and do it quickly. Only these individual choices will translate into the collective action that we need. We must make the right choices. As part of our report, today we are publishing a 10-point global action plan for government and businesses. These 10 practical recommendations can deliver significant economic benefits, and at the same time, most of the emission reductions that we need to avoid dangerous climate change. I will hand a copy of these 10 recommendations to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and hope leaders will use them to make responsible changes. 1 week from now, global leaders will meet in this city. From there, they will start a journey that will continue in Peru this year and in Paris 2015. We have reached a limit. We have a great responsibility to save our common house. With this report, we now have a set of tools that global leaders can use to foster the growth that we all need while reducing the climate risk that we all face. This is what we mean by better growth. This is what we mean by better climate. This is the new climate economy. And now, if you allow me, Mr. Secretary General, I will hand you a copy of the full report and the Global Action Plan, hoping that it will be useful in the challenging task of building a brighter future for humankind. This means not only avoiding an environmental catastrophe, but it also means taking the opportunity to provide our children and grandchildren sustainable economic prosperity. Thank you very much.
Your Excellency, President Felipe Calderon, a co-chair of the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, Lord Nicholas Stern, co-chair of the Global Commission, Mr. Jeremy Oppenheim, Global Program Director, distinguished members of the Global Commission, Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great a pleasure and honor for me to participate in this very meaningful session hosted by the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate Change. And I thank President Calderon for his great leadership. standing in this podium and meeting with you today, I'm feeling a great strength and energy and even heat coming from you. You are generating a lot of energy already. As President said, it's just 1 week ahead of a climate change summit meeting. We expect at least more than 120 prime ministers and above, head of state and government. There are numerous foreign ministers and environment ministers who will be participating. This is going to be a real defining moment for all of us. You are providing such a basis and foundation. I have been working very closely with the President Calderon when he was in his office. I have been visiting Mexico many times. We've been participating in UNFCCC Climate Change Summit meeting, G20 Summit meeting. I have never seen such a passionate and persistent leader, on committed leader on climate change. As a chair of Cancun UNFCCC, he helped adopt it. This Cancun agreement, which is now still the basis of our negotiation, where the idea of a green climate fund was again discussed, and I'm very much grateful. I have noticed that while it says a better growth, a better climate, it says the synthesis report. As you know, as a part of a shaping future development agenda, post-2015 development agenda, member states have been working very hard through open working group, and they are now asking me to support a summit, a synthesis report, which will be again used as some very important element for future deliberations next year. By September next year, this time, we expect the world leaders will adopt the visionary work of sustainable development goals. Now, he has presented a synthesis report when it comes to the climate change dimension, and I'm going to provide one comprehensive synthesis report. So this is a good report, and I will surely make it reflect in my synthesis report. Again, I really thank you again. This report on the new climate economy is timely. Scientists have long warned of the potential implications of climate change for economic growth. We can no longer afford to burn our way to prosperity. We must manage climate risk for sustained and sustainable economic progress. We need a structural transformation in the global economy. This report argues for a new model where economic growth and climate action are mutually reinforcing, and it shows how we can build it. There is no time to lose. Greenhouse gas emissions are at record levels. The effects of climate change are already widespread, costly, and consequential. That is why I'm convening next week's climate change summit meeting. I have invited leaders from the government, the business communities, and civil societies, and NGOs, and philanthropists, and I hope that they will lead this campaign. I expect the summit to deliver on four of the most prominent recommendations in this report. They are crucial to addressing climate change and promoting low-carbon growth. First, the summit should help to lay the framework for putting a price on carbon. Second, it will seek to promote innovative financing instruments such as green bonds. Third, the summit will build the case for removing policy ambiguity. We must encourage innovation for green growth. And fourth, summit will generate momentum for joint initiatives that will decarbonize critical sectors such as energy, land use, and urban planning. And these four recommendations and the broader messages in this report are not just climate relevant. They are central to sustainable development and the post-2015 development agenda. We cannot eradicate extreme poverty without fighting climate change. We need to advance two agendas simultaneously. And the message which President Calderon just mentioned, coming from his own experience as president of Mexico, is really coming to my heart directly. I have never served as a president or prime minister, but having worked with him and having worked with so many presidents, I know that the presidents and prime ministers and all these ministers are surrounded by the advisors who think that these are two separate roads. One, domestic economic growth, the other, investing in climate change. But this is two sides of one coin. I know that President Calderon, when he was in his office, he might have been surrounded by this kind of argument and theories. But now, everybody knows that it is wrong. It's a wrong argument. We are doing all same things in two sides. Same one coin of two sides. Therefore, these two agendas should be addressed simultaneously. Wise investment in climate change will surely help domestic economic growth. This goes hand in hand. Therefore, we have to really change this kind of dynamics, which is shared by many world leaders. With this report, I sincerely hope that decision makers in the public and private sector have a set of concrete recommendations for sustainable low-carbon economic growth. Again, Mr. President and distinguished members of the Commission, I sincerely thank as the Secretary General of the United Nations, who is also as committed as any other world leaders, for your very important contribution to our common efforts, common journey to achieve this climate change agreement by next year. Then thereafter, we have to join all together for a sustainable path for humanity. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much, Secretary General. We're just going to take a very quick photo and then we'll move along with the proceedings. So, President Calderon, Nick, Jeremy, Secretary General, let's just stand in the middle. I'll let you stand there. Jeremy. Okay. Again, sir. Now I have a microphone. Now we're going to show you a short video presentation, and after that, we're going to be hearing from Jeremy Oppenheim. So let's watch the video.
For years, we've been told that we cannot pursue strong economic growth and combat climate change at the same time. But what if that's a false choice? Around the world, countries, cities, and businesses are demonstrating that we can have better living standards and new jobs and a safer climate. We can design better cities, compact and connected cities, with better urban planning and transport systems. We could save $3 trillion over the next 15 years if we build our cities in a smart way. That would create better places to live in and produce less carbon pollution than causes climate change. Using new agricultural techniques, we can produce more food, reduce poverty, and cut carbon pollution. By restoring just 12% of the world's degraded lands, we could feed another 200 million people and raise farmers' incomes by $40 billion a year. As the cost of wind and solar power continues to fall, low-carbon energy is becoming the smart choice to meet energy demand. Most fast-growing economies can already achieve more than a quarter of their new energy needs from renewable sources. And the best part? The investments needed to shift to a low-carbon economy are almost the same as those investments we'll make anyway. Today's technological advances are already creating opportunities for employment and economic growth while reducing climate risks. And if government leaders pursue smart policies, they will accelerate these changes. These are the findings of the new Climate Economy Report from a team of world-class economic experts, heads of government and business leaders. We don't have to choose. We can have a safe climate and a prosperous future. Find out more at www.newclimateeconomy.report.
Let me now introduce to you in person Jeremy Oppenheim, and just to remind you who he is, he's the program director who also, I understand, kindly took a sabbatical from his role as a director at McKinsey to be able to tackle this project. And so we'd like to hear from you, Jeremy, now about what you want to say with regards to the report findings. Over to you.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a great honour to be with everybody today, President Calderon, Lord Stern, distinguished guests. As you've heard, the Secretary-General and President Calderon have painted for us the strategic picture of how we can achieve better growth while tackling dangerous climate change at the same time. And they've also explained to us why taking strong climate action now is the low-cost, low-risk option, why there is no good economic reason for delay, and why, to the contrary, there are good economic reasons to build more and more momentum now behind the low-carbon agenda. But my job is to dig into some of the details. The New Climate Economy Project has worked through the last year with top economic decision-makers in both public and private sectors to understand whether it is possible to combine growth with strong climate action. We have reviewed the theory, but we have especially focused on the practice, what works out in the field, and what are the real obstacles and trade-offs. We have not shied away from those. What has made our work distinctive, I believe, is that we always start with the top priorities of decision makers, what they care about right now, and then try to understand how strong climate action can be integrated into those priorities. So what have we learnt from this dialogue and our work? I mean, is it the case that decision makers see growth in climate action as being in fundamental conflict? And where do they see the most acute, toughest trade-offs? And where do they see potential win-wins? So let me tell you what we've learned. First, the serious decision makers out there increasingly understand that lasting, secure economic growth is only possible with strong climate action. But frankly, they're not always sure how to translate that insight into short and medium-term choices. So they want to learn about how countries like Brazil have managed in less than 20 years to become a global powerhouse in agriculture while at the same time reducing deforestation and cutting greenhouse gas emissions. They also want to learn how to replicate the success of cities like Stockholm and Barcelona in decoupling growth from carbon emissions. And they look to countries as diverse as Ghana and Morocco to understand how they tackle the very complex political challenges of cutting fossil fuel subsidies in a way that makes political sense. Second, decision makers do sense that the trade-offs that President Calderon talked about are shifting, and that today's generation of low-carbon, information-rich technologies can and will outcompete high-carbon, older technologies, technologies that are rooted in much earlier industrial revolutions. This field is no different from any other field. But few decision makers truly appreciate the speed with which competitive dynamics are already changing today. It is still a total surprise to most decision makers that the majority of investments in electricity generation for the past 4 years have been in renewable energy. A low carbon revolution in energy technology is already underway. Third, decision makers are rightly concerned about the rate of economic growth. It's top of mind, especially as it translates into jobs. But they are also increasingly concerned. We heard in conversation after conversation about the quality of economic growth. There's more and more evidence about the health impact of high carbon fossil fuel driven growth. Recent estimates suggest that almost 4 million people die prematurely each year as a result of outdoor air pollution, almost entirely due to fossil fuel combustion. And this, frankly, is just the tip of the iceberg, with a multiple of that number, especially children suffering from respiratory diseases. That burning fossil fuels causes health problems is not news, but the magnitude of the problem and the public awareness of the problem, fueled by social media, is new, and it cannot be swept under the carpet. Finally, we heard time and again just how much uncertainty is the enemy of jobs, investment, and growth. And I'm sure you'll be hearing from Chad Holliday, one of our commissioners, about precisely that topic. Decision makers know that the next 15 years will not be business as usual, not if they're going to get out of the current rut and deliver a new wave of prosperity. Economic ministries know that they need to provide clear direction to investors, especially if they want to attract long-term private capital. But they're also learning that today's contradictory signals on climate action are a major source of uncertainty, especially for investments in energy and urban transport systems. 10 years ago, that policy inconsistency was probably a small deal, if we're honest with ourselves. But today, what's different is that it's a much bigger deal as investors continue to absorb the lessons and the costs of the last financial crisis. Now, to the details, our approach has been to look at three main economic systems: cities, land use, and energy, and to understand how the drivers of change, resource efficiency, better infrastructure investment, and innovation can be harnessed to deliver stronger, more inclusive growth, cleaner air, greater food and energy security, and to do so today, while reducing the risk of dangerous climate change. Our focus has been on the opportunities for better growth and better climate performance over the next 5 to 15 years, what economists think of as short to medium term growth. Over that 15-year period, the world economy will, as President Calderon mentioned, invest around $90 trillion in infrastructure. Now, if we spend that money well, if we direct it towards low-carbon, resource-efficient investments, we should achieve a massive step towards better growth with less climate risk. And for a small extra investment, less than 5% more, we could buy ourselves a lot of insurance. Let's start with the city piece of this. Now, if climate change is mankind's biggest market failure, then urban sprawl comes a close second. Estimates conducted for the New Climate Economy Project suggest that urban sprawl just in the US costs the equivalent of $400 billion per year. Our work looked at urban development across the world, and we learned that there are huge economic gains from shifting to more compact cities. These could be worth up to $3 trillion over the next 15 years. We see huge welfare gains, not only through less traffic congestion and fewer road accidents. And by the way, remember that over 1 million people are killed each year in road accidents, with over 50 million injured, the majority of these in developing countries. But more compact cities with better public transport systems also deliver better air quality and make it much easier for low-income households in particular to access jobs. And this is not just a story about new cities and new neighborhoods. Our research also looked hard at how well-established cities such as London and New York, Houston and Beijing can redensify and become better connected. We are frankly blown away in our work by the potential for new forms of mobility on demand, combining public transport systems such as the bus rapid transit, if you go back one, with new forms of car sharing, the revival of bicycling, smarter ways of allocating road and parking capacity, coupled with opportunities to digitize public and private transport. We are entering a new era of personal mobility, and this is the next 15 years are an astonishing opportunity to get on top of that. Now, our land use systems, just as our urban systems, are ripe for the next green revolution, if I can steal your language. We can double yield growth over the next 15 years and at the same time cut greenhouse gas emissions from land use through better seeds, smarter, more targeted use of fertilizers, mobile applications of big data, that's the digital thing again, and better land use practices. And to do so in ways that benefit smallholders in developing countries such as Indonesia, as well as large commercial farmers. Second, there are now over a billion hectares of degraded land across the world, but countries as diverse as China, Ethiopia, and Niger are bringing that degraded land back into productive use, creating rural incomes, expanding food supplies, and again, sequestering carbon. We continue to lose or waste up to a third of food across the world, but we've also learned how to cut that food waste. And the good news is that leading supermarkets and consumer goods companies, who in truth probably 10 years ago were part of the problem, are now actively part of the solution. And then finally, within land use on forests, countries ranging from Brazil to Mexico to India are showing what it takes to protect their natural forests, not only to act as the lungs of the world, and not only to protect and preserve the value of biodiversity, but also to help us drive up agricultural yields through better soil fertility and water retention. Better forests equals and contributes to better agriculture. About 350 million people across the world depend on forests for their livelihood. So looking after them properly can make all the difference and create new opportunities for some of the poorest communities on the planet. Now, this would not be a talk about climate and the economy without talking about energy systems. And we need energy systems that are fit for purpose in the 21st century. This part of our work has to start with energy efficiency. Always the bridesmaid in so many energy discussions, but not often enough the bride. Increasing energy efficiency from the historic rate of about 1% improvement each year to 2% would save us up to 20% of energy in 2030. And that is, just to give you a sense of the scale, more than the total energy consumption of US, India, and Japan today. So we have the technology, and just to give you a sense of that, I mean, China has already installed over 250 million smart meters across their economy. But it's now all about getting energy pricing right, eliminating fossil fuel subsidies, using information technology to transform grid performance and to shift individual behavior, and building our homes and our offices and our factories right first time. We also need an energy system which is clean at a local level as well as globally. The combustion, as I mentioned before, of fossil fuels is killing millions of people prematurely across the planet. Work conducted for the Commission indicates that the value of these lost lives is estimated at over 4% of GDP in the top 15 emitting countries. Coal is the biggest but not the only offender. 15 years ago, many countries did not have a mainstream, scalable alternative to the use of coal in their electricity systems. But today, there are expanding cost-competitive options, from wind to solar to hydro to nuclear to gas. We no longer have the luxury to just pick and choose, and one of the Commission's strong convictions is that countries will have to deploy the full palette of low-carbon electricity options in combinations that make sense locally, and that in particular expand access for the 1.3 billion people who still lack modern electricity services. So a small investment now in cleaner, more secure energy will not only save lives today and expand access, but it is the best insurance against growing future climate risks. So all of this adds up to a huge opportunity for all of us and for business in particular. Better cities, better land use and energy systems are a $90 trillion value creation opportunity. There's no shortage of global capital for this investment, albeit that we need some smart, better financial instruments to get after that capital. Nor is there a shortage of technology, nor, frankly, of innovative, disruptive business models that can cut costs and cut carbon pollution at the same time. But this will not happen on its own. Rather, it will take decisive action by governments acting in their own national self-interest to put in place strong, credible market signals, including carbon pricing, that can redirect this capital and innovation to a low-carbon future, and to do so on the principles of a just transition. If we use the next 15 years wisely, our research shows that it is possible to build a low-carbon economy that is good for people, good for business, and good for the planet. The Global Commission estimates that it is possible to deliver 50 to 90% of the emissions reductions needed to get onto at least the 2030 part of the two-degree pathway, based on actions that are good economics before considering the climate benefits. Getting to 2030, as Lord Stern will tell us, I'm sure, will not be the end of the story. After 2030, the world economy will need to keep on building out its low-carbon pathway. Further transformation will be essential to squeeze carbon out of the economy. Our work does not pretend that the music stops in 2030. However, our focus is deliberately and unerringly on the next 15 years. We either use them to decarbonize in ways that are clearly economically productive and clearly socially beneficial, especially for poorer households and communities, or we lose the opportunity to redirect $90 trillion of investment firepower towards a low carbon, less risky and more productive future. The good news is that there's already action underway. This is not a report about theory. It's about scaling actions that we can already see in terms of increasing agricultural production and protecting forests at the same time, driving energy efficiency and renewable energy, and building better cities. So to build on the progress that we already see and to press hard on the low carbon accelerator, we need a plan, one that sends clear, consistent messages that everyone can trust. So let me hand over the platform to Lord Nicola Stern, who will join me to describe the 10 transformative actions that form the Global Commission's plan for better growth and a better climate, and to give us a frame for that plan.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Felipe Calderon, for your leadership, and thank you, Jeremy, for leading the team that did all the hard work, and thank you, Mandy, for coordinating us in our discussion today. And thank you all for coming. This report's about growth. Growth is driven by investment in physical capital, human capital, technology, know-how, and so on. So this report is about the conditions for investment, particularly recognizing that much of that investment will be private sector investment. We've seen from what you've already heard this morning, that if we invest well in cities, land, energy, we can go much of the way to making the necessary emissions reductions by 2030. We will, of course, have to do much more afterwards, but we can set ourselves on the way. And these are investments with strong economic and social returns to the countries making those investments. They will include reductions in waste, pollution, congestion, degradation of land. But they will be strong returns to that country making the investment before counting the benefits for climate change. And of course, we should also count the benefit for climate change. But will those investments in the advancement of that country and its standards of living, which Jeremy and his team have shown are there, will those investments take place? Will there be an investment climate which allows those investments to foster and to prosper in the market system? They won't all be market investments, but many of them, probably a majority of them, will be market-based private investment. So the challenge of policy is to create the conditions in which these good investments actually happen. And that's what's motivated the policy design in these 10 statements that we're going to make, this global action plan. Of course, it's not just about designing good policy. It fundamentally is about designing good policy, but it's not just about that. It also has to be clear, stable, and credible, because many of these investments are for the long term. So the framework that we've designed here, the global proposals, are policy design, but also with stability and confidence and credibility in mind. So what are they? And let us run through those 10 elements of the Global Action Plan. I'm going to run through the first six, which are clearly about the story I've just told, creating the investment climate in which these valuable investments will actually be realized. Remembering, of course, that there are social benefits through air pollution that they bring. There are barriers to long-term finance, which might prevent these investments taking place. There's research and development, which is enormously important, where the market doesn't always yield to the those doing the research and development, the returns in terms of discovery that their activities bring. These are the kinds of things that motivate what we're describing here. So here they are. The proposals, the Global Action Plan, is directed to governments, businesses, city authorities, and to others. The first element, it doesn't sound very exciting as you state it, but it actually really matters. It's integrate climate risk and climate action into the core economic strategies and decision-making. Awareness and measurement matter enormously to behaviour. So whilst it's the blandest of the recommendations, we shouldn't interpret it as being trivial. Far from it. Measurement, awareness, change behaviour. Secondly, enter into a strong, lasting, and equitable international climate agreement. Such an agreement makes it politically, in one country, easier to pursue these policies, easier to take the tough decisions, because you can recognise that others are making the same journey. You're not on your own, that big markets will come. So it's important politically to investment and decisions for investment. It's important for businesses who can see the direction of travel if there's an international agreement. And it's important for finance, those who would finance those investments, again, need the confidence, and particularly for developing countries, this is it's very important to get those flows moving, for example, through Green Climate Fund and in other ways. It has to be equitable. An inequitable agreement would not last and would not deserve to last. It's the poorest who are hit earliest and hardest by climate change. It's the poorest who have contributed least to the emissions of greenhouse gases that are causing that change. Equity in the agreement is vital because it's right. This is about poverty reduction and growth. And it's vital, of course, to the stability and credibility of that agreement. Phase out subsidies for fossil fuels and agricultural inputs and incentives for urban sprawl. It really is mad to subsidise very damaging activities. It's very important to phase that out. Jeremy and Oppenheim and President Calderon have indicated the scale of those subsidies. We must introduce strong and predictable carbon prices. At the moment, we subsidise the emissions of carbon in the sense that we allow people to dump a very damaging pollutant, the greenhouse gases, in the atmosphere for free. That's subsidising pollution by letting people do very damaging things for nothing. We have to have a strong and predictable carbon price, and I'm on record as saying that this is the greatest market failure the world has ever seen. We're all involved and we all suffer the damages, and those damages and risks are potentially immense. We must bring down, fifthly, we must bring down capital costs for low infrastructure investments, because we recognise that these are long-term investments. They inevitably involve some risk, and long-term capital markets don't necessarily handle the risk all that well. Lots of ways of doing it: green bonds, yield codes, changing the regulations to make it much easier for pension funds to invest in what really are good long-term investments, international development banks. There's a whole collection of ways in which we can do that, including making sure the $100 billion a year promised in Cancun from rich countries to poorer countries really does flow by 2020 as promised. Sixth, scale up innovation in the key low carbon and climate resilient technologies and remove barriers to entrepreneurship and creativity. Investment in R&D in the energy sector is something that has stagnated, declined. It is time for us to step up again and to triple to $100 billion public R&D investment by mid-2020. That is a crucial part of the recommendations. There are all sorts of other barriers which I won't go into here, such as access to grid. There's a lot you can do in encouraging entrepreneurship by clear standards that we've seen, for example, emission reductions in cars and so on. Lots more we can do to scale up innovation, but investing much more in R&D will be a key part of it, and in particular $100 billion by 2020. So if you put those six things together, then the climate for the realization of the strong investments which Jeremy described would be there, and they have a chance of happening. Let me, for the last four of our recommendations, particularly connected with cities, land use, and energy, hand back to Jeremy.
So just to complete, action area number seven is around cities, and is simply to make connected and compact cities the preferred, the default form of urban development. Today, the default is low density and unstructured, and on current trends, you know, the world's urban area will triple between 2000 and 2030, locking cities into a high-cost, congested, and environmentally challenged future. So what will it take to change this? First, a shift in mindset and policy direction and policy signals at the level of economic ministries. Cities are now too important, if you will, just to be left to happen. They need to be at the heart of economic planning. Second, we, as Lord Stern put it, we need to see the phasing out of those subsidies, explicit and hidden, that encourage and subsidize urban sprawl. Third, we need a significant strengthening of urban planning capabilities. It's another of those dull recommendations, but that is absolutely essential to have real change happen on the ground. And then finally, we want to see the development of much stronger financing capacity at the municipal level, typically linked to the economic value of greater urban density. The eighth action area is around halting the deforestation of natural forests by 2030. And over the past decade, we have continued to lose natural forests at around a net rate of 5 million hectares per year, causing both local and global environmental damage. And while deforestation appears to have slowed a bit, it is far from under control. So what will it take to change this? First, forest-rich countries, and we will hear from Pak Heru later on, will need to continue building their capacity to protect their forests, combining community-based stewardship with the very latest technology, from satellites that provide eyes in the sky to smartphones on the ground. We need to have both. It's a blend. Second, developed countries need to scale up their contribution. And our estimate is that, and it's following that of many others, is that we need to scale up to around $5 billion a year of payments for RED Plus, which should be increasingly focused on payments for performance. And then third, business needs to deliver on its zero deforestation supply chain agenda. And there are very, very positive signs on that. There are representatives of consumer goods companies here in the room, and we know that that's going to be a big theme over the coming, not just week, but years ahead. Ninth area is also in land use. We as a commission, believe that it's critical to restore at least 500 million hectares of degraded forests and agricultural land by 2030, building on our growing experience in countries such as China, Vietnam, and Niger. Africa today has over 300 million hectares of dry lands with significant agricultural potential, and we need to build the partnerships that will get this land back into productive use. And last, but by no means least, the Global Commission believes that it is time to accelerate the shift away from polluting coal-fired power generation. Our estimates suggest that around 80% of the emissions reductions needed in the energy sector over the next 15 years could come from progressively phasing out coal. And we could do that at less than 20% of the potential stranded asset cost. So we should get after coal. Given coal's momentum in recent years, what will it take to achieve this shift? Especially if we are to achieve a global phase out of unabated fossil fuel power generation by 2050. First, high-income countries need to commit now, not tomorrow, but now, to end the building of new unabated coal-fired power plants and to accelerate early retirements of existing unabated capacity. Second, middle-income countries should halt the new build by 2025, earlier if possible. Third, governments need to reverse the burden of proof, only building new coal-fired power plants if the alternatives are really not feasible. And then finally, we need to see subsidies for the coal value chain stopping. Around the world, there are already countries which have started to implement major elements, not just of this one recommendation, but of all 10. There are cities which are showing what is possible, and there are businesses who are showing what is possible. It's not that we're proposing radically new and different actions. Our 10-point action plan is building on elements that are out there but now need to be delivered comprehensively at scale. This is very much a case where 1 and 1 equals 3, it's a case where there are huge positive network effects, the more countries, cities, and companies that join in. So what if the majority of countries, cities, and companies were to follow the broad direction of the global action plan? Just stop and imagine, just for a moment, what the world economy could look like in 15 years' time. Stop and think what a different world economy could be, not in 50 years' time, but in 15 years' time, if we were to follow through on the report and its plan. Just imagine what might be possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Thank you very much, Lord Nicholas Stern. I'm going to invite a couple more voices up to the stage here so that we can do a panel discussion. I'm going to be asking a few questions to the panel, and then I'm going to open it up to the audience. So while they're talking, maybe you can all think about something that you would like to direct to our panelists in terms of your own questions from the report findings. I'm also going to give the media over here at the side of the room. I am myself a member of the media, so I know what it's like. You're probably itching to ask some questions as well. So don't worry, you will be given opportunity to ask some questions later too. So let me now introduce a couple more people to bring up to the front here. Chad Holliday, he's the chairman of Bank of America. Thank you very much, sir, for joining us today. And also His Excellency Pak Heru Prasetyo, the head of the Indonesian National Red Plus Agency. Thank you very much for joining us here. Mm-hmm. We're just going to move this lectern and we'll consolidate our positioning to make it easier for everybody to speak. Myself included, a little bit of housekeeping. Just make sure, everybody, that your red button is on to make sure that all of our microphones are working. This red button down here on the side, lower left.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
Okay, we just leave those on. Great. Leave it on. Yes.
All right.
Okay. Everybody's got their microphones. Okay, everybody can hear, I'm assuming. So I'm just going to ask a few questions, and again, then I'm going to open it up to the audience. So my first question... Jeremy, I'm going to pose this to you, and I ask this with all due respect, but We've been talking about reducing our dependence on fossil fuels for decades now. We've been talking about tackling climate change and protecting the environment for decades. So what makes you think that this report today will make a real difference?
So Mandy, thank you. I'm going to take 10 seconds and no more. There are two simple reasons why this report, I think, can make a difference. One is that it is based on the real-world experience of investments that are successful in addressing better growth and better climate at the same time, in policies that are successful, in cities that are doing it right. So this is about taking what we've learned over the last few years and taking it to global scale.
Mm-hmm. So Nick. There we go, I'll just hold it on. So Nick, you've been talking essentially about this being a special moment in time. We have a window of opportunity. If we don't seize it now, it may close to dire consequences. Why is now so important to seize, and why are the next 15 years so critical?
Mandy, it is indeed a remarkable moment in time because we've got two transformations which are time critical going on at the same time. The first transformation is of the world economic structure. 25 years ago or so, developing emerging market countries were around one third of the world's GDP. Now they're more than a half. 25 years from now, it'll probably be two thirds. So we're seeing a big structural transformation in international division of activity. Cities, urban areas, 50% of the population now, 70% by the middle of this century. Mm-hmm. These are the kinds of transformations we're going to see. We don't know exactly, of course, but next couple of decades, around 40% increase in energy demand. These are fundamental structural changes, and at the same time, the next 15 or 20 years will determine whether do we destroy our forests or not. Mm-hmm. This is profound structural change. Nothing what I've just said uses the words climate change. At the same time, the levels of concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are higher than they've been for millions of years. Already close to 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent. If we go on adding at the same rate for another 15, 20, 30 years, we will have lost the chance of holding to 2 degrees. These two things are happening in the next 15, 20, 25 years. If we delay action, if we get them wrong, if we're casual, if we try to carry on in the same kind of high carbon way. With the first transformation, we'll have locked in the dirty, congested, polluting story. It'll be very hard to get out of it. At the same time, we'll have locked in those emissions. So if we miss this opportunity, if we don't use these two transformations coming together like this in a good way, as Jeremy in the report describes, if we don't do that, we're in deep trouble. And it's lives, livelihoods of our children, their children, which will be directly affected. So we either use this opportunity, and it's extremely attractive, what Jeremy tried to ask us to imagine at the end, or we do not, and it's deeply unattractive.
Mm-hmm. And the reality is that there has to be an economic incentive. It can't come at the cost of economic growth. So, Chad, perhaps you can speak a little bit about that side of things. I know you believe that the economy, not just here, but in many places around the world, is either stuck in neutral or in some cases even going in reverse. So what are your key takeaways from the report that make you believe that we can do this while also progressing economically?
So as I think about this, I think about all my colleagues in business that I've known so well over the years, and I look at their routine in the morning. They get up and they read the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, then they watch CNBC, I'm sorry, it's third, or their equivalent somewhere around the world. And they're looking at those things for two reasons. They're trying to find opportunities to maximize or risk to minimize. That's the only two reasons they watch your show. What I would suggest to them today, if you'd read this report, you will find more opportunities to maximize and risk to minimize than you will any other place today. So I would say change differently. Let me point out three of the opportunities, three of the areas that really stand out to me. If you look at this report, it says coal is a risk to be minimized and natural gas is an opportunity to be maximized. And if you take carbon capture and storage and the 21 major projects under construction or operating today for carbon capture, you can minimize the risk of natural gas even more. A real clear one. The second one, I think on your show in the last few years, I don't think you've ever accused financial services institutions of being not creative in their instruments or slow to act. This report says they have been just that in these areas until about 3 years ago. So the opportunities for green bonds, which the Secretary General mentioned earlier, has grown exponentially. The opportunities to put together structured instruments that measure the risk and be able to present to an investor the risk, talk about how to bring the development banks in a different way, are clearly there today. This is an opportunity to be maximized with financial services institutions, and I'm glad to see Bank of America working with Sustainable Energy for All of the UN is one member of that. The last item is shale gas. And Mandy, on your program, you always ask your guests, why did we miss the shale gas revolution?
Right.
That's an interesting question, but not the most interesting you could ask. The more interesting question is, what is the next shale gas revolution? And you have to read between the lines, Jeremy, to get this out of this report. So I'm stretching a bit. It's energy efficiency. I would be shocked if energy efficiency doesn't have a greater impact on the world than shale gas does in the next 5 years. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. So it's clear the capital there is there. It's there for the necessary investments to achieve these goals. We just have to maybe be a little bit creative and innovative. Green bonds is an excellent idea. Well, let's now get to you, Pākehru, because Jeremy spoke a lot about how we could better use land, how we need to tackle deforestation and reforest in many cases. This is something that I know Indonesia has had a lot of experience with. Tell us what you can impart in terms of tackling deforestation at the same time as also helping the economy, because I believe that what Indonesia is doing could maybe show some leadership to other developing countries.
Thank you, Mandy. Well, Indonesia is one of the commissioning countries. Mm-hmm. And being a commissioning country, definitely we are the user of this report moving forward. Indonesia has a very interesting landscape. It has islands, but it also has oceans. I think the last report of the World Meteorological Organization shows not only emission emitting is something that is important to address, but also absorbing the carbon that's already in the sky. And the absorbent, the main absorbent, is basically the forest and the sea, and we have both. So Indonesia is very concerned about this. And so when you're talking about how to go about it and creating growth, at the same time, reducing emissions and increasing the ability to absorb carbon is about report recommendation number 8 and 9. You're talking about reducing deforestation, but at the same time, doing restore the 500 million hectares of lost and damaged land. One key development agenda onto that is definitely the sustainable growth with equity. For the past years, we have been threading in the way that development is the more important part when actually distributing the wealth as well as protecting the environment is put in the back burner. Now, the government of Indonesia has started moving into that intuitively and also with information and technology that we can get hold of. This report gives us the confidence that actually after a report that was done collectively, collaboratively around the world, we have now the basis to be able to do that in a more proper way. We still have some difficulties, and it's not easy, a very complex issue when you're talking about forest and peatland, but now with this report, we believe that there will be a support. And I don't know in this case, when you go into the deeper between the line message, are we also addressing the potential of decoralization beyond deforestation? I think that will be another issue that is going to be very important moving forward. because that is also the ability to absorb carbon that is already in the sky. I think this is very important to add in the thought moving toward green economy in the future.
But how do you incentivize those to stop deforestation?
Two things. The first thing is increasing productivity. We know that our forest is being used in a way that is less productive than it should. And it means that the productivity of the smallholders of the palm oil companies as well as the timber for pulp and paper, the smallholders for that, the productivity is quite low. So we need to inject more productivity with technology, with investment, with the supply chains method that makes it more productive. That is one, in terms of increasing the productivity so that the demand of the global world on those commodity can actually be achieved without more deforestation. That's one. The second is in terms of the recovering the degraded forests and degraded land. We have a lot of those degraded land and degraded forests because of past practices. So we need to get into that as well. That's why I mentioned that this report is very apt in terms of talking about not only reducing deforestation, but also doing the reforestation for the degraded land. Mm-hmm.
President Calderon, yes.
Yeah. Let me add on that. Other way to do that is we have a great example coming from one of the members of the commission, Paul Polman, the CEO of Unilever, which is right now in Addis Ababa launching the report. So a big problem is the plantation for palm oil, for instance. Mm-hmm. Palm oil is probably one of the most required products in the supermarket, from soap to shampoo to a lot of food. It's coming from oil, in particular from palm oil. But the problem is producers of palm oil were devastating the rainforest everywhere. So Unilever, the Paul Polman company, decided to buy only palm oil coming from certified plantations that are not degrading rainforest. Now, producing palm oil, it's a real revenue for the poorest families in several countries because they are very well paid by Unilever and other companies. And then they are recovering the soil, they are preventing the deforestation, and we are matching two goals, preventing deforestation and providing real economic input for poor families. So the key issue, again, is to match environment and economic issues. Other point could be payment for environmental services that we are doing in Mexico, and Costa Rica made it. Costa Rica started to pay some money from each hectare which is preserved in indigenous communities. So Costa Rica started to stop the deforestation, and started to increase the surface of forests. And today, ecotourism is the main activity providing currencies, or providing foreign currency to Costa Rica. So the point is, how can you provide real income for those families living in poverty and living in those forest regions and rainforests, and at the same time preserve the environment? That is possible, and that is the way to do so.
But you need political will to achieve that. And this is a sensitive question, but do you think we have the right leadership globally to be able to tackle some of these issues and make the hard decisions? Do you think there is the political will out there with the leadership that we have right now?
What is the question? I'm sorry. No, well, the point is, let me see why, let me tell what I do believe. Political leadership corresponds to social responsibility of the citizens. So yes, there are several strong political leaders, some of them members of the Commission, by the way. I'm thinking in Jens Stoltenberg, the former Prime Minister of Norway, which is now leading, by the way, NATO in the coming October. Difficult task, but he has real political leadership. And there are other societies that could push their leaders to have real commitment. Mm-hmm. And that's the key issue. This report is calling upon the political responsibility, but also is calling upon the social and civil responsibility on the citizens, mm-hmm. pushing for their leaders.
Mm-hmm. So, sorry, did you want to add something,
Pakaru? Yeah, if I may, Mandy. I think that what the President Calderon mentioned is very true. When you're talking about combating climate change and also creating growth, you need to have the concept of inter-community work. Government is just one of the communities. The private sector is another community. What he mentioned about Unilever working with Indonesia and other countries, developing the smallholders' productivity, and perhaps in the year 2030, most of the palm oil taken from those countries will come from the smallholder that's already being developed now for high productivity and good sustainability, is actually creating that. That is a show of the leadership whereby the government and the private sector work together for the same objective. Mm-hmm. So I think that is your questions in terms of leadership.
Yeah.
It should be drawn not only from government, but of the combinations of the government, the community, as well as the private sector.
Good point. And I think at the end of the day, for the private and public sector to be able to move forward on this, we need a stable, predictable system in place, so businesses can make the right decisions, so society can make the right decisions, so the public arena can make the right decisions. So, Chad, perhaps this is a good opportunity to talk a little bit more about carbon pricing. I know, Jeremy, you mentioned carbon pricing, but from a business perspective, what are your views on that? And obviously that requires a very predictable and stable system.
Yeah, a great question. And pricing in the externalities, carbon and other greenhouse gases, are critical. You know, my personal view is we do not need a sledgehammer, we need a nudge. I believe on your show you cover Janet Yellen all the time, and all she has to do is look or wink in some way, that's enough to move the market. So I believe if our political leaders could give it a nudge so we see there is a clear direction, we're going this way, I wouldn't worry so much about the rate as we start. But as long as we're moving, political leaders, and they could do this next week, give us the feeling this is the direction we're going, this is the new economy, I think what you'll see is business never wants to be behind the curve. Mm-hmm. So they will move very fast to be ahead of that.
Sure.
They might even overshoot a little bit. What a good problem to have.
And I think it's also fair to say that a lot of these goals are going to be difficult to achieve, right, Jeremy? I mean, you said that yourself. You know, we can't be pie in the sky thinking this is going to be easy, because it's not necessarily going to be easy. And Nick, perhaps you can talk to this. It's not that suddenly we're going to switch over to all renewable energies. What role will there still be for example, coal still as a form of energy in the next 15 years, maybe even nuclear energy? We can't suddenly just move over to wind and solar power.
Thank you, Mandy. I think the message of the report is to get out of unabated coal, in other words, coal without carbon capture, as fast as we possibly can. And that is pretty fast. It can't be done overnight, but rich countries could and should stop building unabated coal stations now.
Mm-hmm.
And there are the alternatives. Gas can be a bridge in the medium term. Not in the very long term, because we've got a lot beyond 2030 and really bring down emissions right through the century. And as the Secretary General of the OECD, Angel Gurría, has argued, and rightly so, by the second half of this century, energy has to be decarbonized. Mm-hmm. So gas is a bridge, but you know, not for very long, unless, of course, as Chad emphasized, it's abated. It's got carbon capture and storage, so we should plan for that. And we probably could do that with a carbon price of $50 or so a ton of CO2 in the medium term. So we have to think, get out of coal as fast as possible, look at all the possible sources of energy. I wouldn't rule anyone out. As soon as you start ruling one out, you run out of opportunities. You've got to have systems that match each other. You know, you need big base loads, and you've got to handle the peaks. But I think that moving very quickly away from coal is possible. And you asked about political will, and let me link coal and China.
Oh, yes.
Because you can't talk about coal without talking
Absolutely.
About China. China uses about half the world's mm-hmm. coal. China is showing very powerfully the political will to change. They've made very clear, and it's intensified across the change of leadership in China, that they regard their current patterns of development as unsustainable. Mm-hmm. Unsustainable in terms of air pollution, unsustainable in terms of congestion, and unsustainable in what they're doing or contributing as part of a world and the biggest emitter to climate change. That political will is there in China, and people ask me how has political will moved in the last 7 or 8 years. That's where I start, and it really has changed very strongly, and they're seeing coal, unabated coal, correctly as the villain of the piece.
That's actually a very timely comment, Nick, because I don't know whether you saw the news overnight, but there was an announcement that China is moving to reduce its imports of coal volumes and to reduce the reliance on coal that obviously has either a high ash or sulfur content, which is terrible for Australian coal exporters, but good in terms of reducing smog and air pollution.
And the leading energy researchers in China were working with us on this report. And they are precisely the people who have been pushing on that frontier in China.
Excellent. Yes, the headline here is China to ban coal with high ash and sulfur from the Wall Street Journal, literally just in the last 12 hours. Jeremy, would you like to make a point on that?
No, the only thing I would add is to just reinforce Chad's point, which is that in addition to the full range of energy sources that are available and are getting, you know, more competitive year by year, let's never underestimate the role of energy efficiency. It has a huge part in this puzzle. And if I made the simple point in the presentation that if we could drive up the rate of increased energy productivity from 1% a year, which is kind of the historic number, to 2%, it changes the game. It takes 20% or so out of world energy demand in 2030. And most of that is driven by new technologies. It's driven by some old technologies, some very basic things like insulation. And the benefits of that are not just about climate. Right? I mean, I just want to give you one small example from my own country. If we can drive better energy efficiency through better insulation, then it reduces the number of older people who end up in hospitals in winter. Because what we have in the UK is a system where actually, and it's not just in the UK, fuel poverty amongst older people drives their vulnerability to respiratory diseases in the winter, and that drives up the health cost of the UK system. So if we can get some of these things right around energy efficiency, not only is it good at the level of energy, but the economic value and the social benefits, particularly to those that are vulnerable, are immense.
Excellent point. I could stay up here and ask questions all day, but I'm going to share the love around a little bit. Perhaps I'd like to open it to the media now in the corner there. If you have any questions, now is the chance. And if you'd also like to say who you would like to address the questions specifically to.
Hi. Yeah. Can I ask the first question?
Yes,
from
please.
Past Blue, we cover the UN. I haven't heard any discussion about cars and the use of cars. So maybe I missed that. But what is the relevance of the growing use and manufacture of cars in terms of pollution? Thanks.
Who would specifically like to address that? Jeremy?
So look, we have a very strong position on that agenda, and that is that over the next 10, 15 years, the really important shift that needs to take place is in the way in which public transport systems develop, in the way in which cities and the urban form develops. Our view is that a world that continues to expand conventional motorization over the next 15 years on the same basis as has happened over the last 15 years will end up as a world that has ground to a halt, where we are stuck in a series of traffic jams and that drive down the productivity of cities that ought to be engines for wealth. And there are tremendous estimates out there. There's something in the order of 20% of fuel is wasted looking for parking spots right now. Similar numbers are offered out there for the fuel wasted in congestion, right, and getting stuck in traffic jams. So you can look at the fuel numbers, you can look at the livability, just the simple livability of cities. You can look at the road accidents. Every way you look, the story that we've got has run its course. And what we believe and see is that there are
strong social trends, strong technological trends, and immense opportunities to shift the way in which we think about personal mobility. And the future ought to be about mobility on demand, where I can actually get the kind of mobility I need and not just rely on the one car that I happen to own. So that's the direction that we are encouraging and look for policymakers and business to get behind it.
You've obviously tried to park a car in New York City. You can literally drive around for half an hour. It's just crazy. Would there be another question from the media before we move on? I will open it to the audience in just a second, but just to move along with the program for the moment, I'd like to introduce another couple of voices to speak just very briefly. But these comments are from a couple of our partner institutions who have contributed to the report and also to the research effort. So let me introduce, first of all, Manish Bapna, Executive Vice President and Managing Director of the World Resources Institute, which is the managing partner for the New Climate Economy Report. So Manish, if you'd like to just stand there, and we'll bring you over a microphone. And please, take it away.
Thank you, Mandy. I want to start by recognizing the exceptional investment that so many people have put into delivering this report today. Too long a list to name everyone individually, but it was a real deep commitment, late nights, lost weekends, a true labor of love. So thank you. What I wanted to do was to elaborate briefly a bit more on poverty and the new climate economy. As the Secretary General said earlier, a big debate is taking place in the UN today regarding the design of the post-2015 development agenda. The high-level objective of these goals is to eradicate extreme poverty by 2030. So does the shift to a new climate economy help or hinder these efforts? And the conventional argument is that climate change under business-as-usual conditions will undercut efforts to tackle poverty. The costs of not acting on climate change are immense in terms of what it will mean for poor people around the world. This is absolutely true. What this report does is to describe how the transition to a low-carbon future can also be instrumental in tackling poverty. What was particularly striking was that we found in the course of the research many, many examples that we came across that both tackle poverty head-on and reduce greenhouse gas emissions at scale. And just to give you a couple of quick examples, Jeremy mentioned in land use the example in Niger, or in Rwanda, or Ethiopia, or South India, where farmers in agriculture, farming in very kind of poor quality degraded land. We saw where investments in restoring the quality of that land by planting trees and shrubs, by managing livestock grazing more effectively, by retaining water, could have massive implications in terms of improving crop productivity, in terms of building resilience, and reducing emissions, kind of a triple win. If one were to look at energy access, 1.3 billion people today still don't have access to modern forms of electricity, primarily in Africa and in South Asia. And we're beginning to see clean energy now increasingly outcompete fossil-based energy on price in many places around the world. If one were to look at cities, we see modern bus systems, such as bus rapid transit, that can provide high-quality mobility services that are a fraction of the cost of metro or cars. And these systems also reduce air pollution, they reduce traffic or congestion time, and they reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's a crucially important solution for the poor. So as President Calderon said, the central message from this report is one does not have to choose between growth and climate change. And I would argue a corollary message is that one also does not have to choose between tackling poverty and tackling climate change either. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Manish. Tom Heller is also here in the audience. He's the executive director of the Climate Policy Initiative. So, Tom, if you would like to say a couple of words as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mandy. This is working?
Yes.
Just a few points that often reinforce some of the things that were said by members of the panel.
The report is very clear that the costs of low-carbon technologies are coming down, and countries around the world at all levels of income have been demonstrating a willingness to pay some of the incremental costs for these newer technologies, especially wind and solar, onshore utility scale. We asked, and following the Commission's guidance in the finance chapter, whether innovative finance could further reduce the spreads between fossil fuels and various forms of low-carbon energy. And we tried to field three other questions that various finance ministers and people from financial institutions threw at us. Basically, I think the critical ones were, what are the total investment needs that are placed on the capital system, and what are these needs going to do to the macroeconomic costs of finance in a given country? They asked us, secondly, how can we transfer capital more effectively from countries that are capital rich, usually in the developed world, to countries where the cost of debt principally is much higher in the developing world? And finally, we were asked about whether the fossil assets really do pose threats to the stability of financial systems if they become stranded. And I would say that the main messages that come out of the chapters, and I would simply urge these analyses to you to look at, are that the cost of transition from a high fossil, high carbon system to a low carbon system actually can end up saving the world about $1.8 trillion over the next 20 years. That's true for all countries, high income and low income countries, and it is true essentially for three reasons. First, you have to ask the right question. It is not a question of what is the gross amount of capital that is needed. It is a question of looking at the full financial flows, the opportunity or the avoided costs of capital that is saved or operational costs that are saved. And it's a function of understanding the value that is lost in this transition. So looking at the full financial flows, the opportunities for saving money are much greater. In that flow, in that analysis, it is critical that we get the pricing of renewables rights. Jeremy made this point. In many ways, renewable energy are much more like toasters than they are nuclear plants. They are not that complicated. You set them up and they run. What they need are financings that are reflecting the risks associated with that. They are more like bonds than they are like equity. We find that the price can come down 20 to 30% with proper financial engineering, and that's true around the world. And finally, it's really important to understand that a system dominated by low-carbon energy is a different energy system than the one we have right now. It's different in finance. It's different in business organization. It's different in policy. And if, in making the investments of shifting those systems, we take advantage, as Jeremy said, of new network technologies for control systems, better material science for storage, the opportunities to save energy and increase resource productivity are enormous. Just 2 points in passing, I want to reiterate what Chad said. As the question of moving money from high capital systems, abundant capital systems, to low, there are additional risks. It is not easy. They have to do with currency risk. They have to do with regulatory risk. But there are new efforts to create specialized instruments, structured finance, that can cut these costs very substantially over what we have now. And the last question, stranded assets, that is asked. What we have found is that more than 70% of the value at risk across the world with fossil asset holders, the long-term investors who have put up the money for these very large systems, 70% of that risk is in the hands of government, not in the hands of private investors. Therefore, we find different implications. Most of that risk is in China and India, where you have young fleets of relatively efficient fossil fuel, but those young fleets are not amortized. And finally, we find very importantly that if you manage the retirements or the use of those plants, not as baseload power, but as reserve power, you can cut the costs of value being destroyed very, very substantially. So intelligent management, again, becomes critical. The economics are clear. The finances are manageable. The politics, as always, somewhat less certain, always more important.
You make a good case. Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Okay, ladies and gentlemen in the audience, now it is your turn to speak. So we're going to take some questions from the audience. All you need to do is raise your hand, and then once I've asked you to speak, you just press the little, I think it's a black button on your lectern, and that should enable your microphone. Yes, sir. And also, maybe you can specify who you would like to address your question to.
Thank you. My name's Harris Gleckman with Benchmark Environmental Consulting, a former UN staff member, and worked around the climate issues for a while. The agreement that we're now looking at going forward is going to be a voluntary agreement by governments and a voluntary series of understanding from the corporate sector. My question really addresses the second and the fourth action points in the paper. To what extent do you see evidence that the Copenhagen Accord, which was a voluntary undertaking, met the requirements that you're laying out for 2 and 4, because the track that we are on a governmental level going toward looks like Copenhagen Accord 2 with its core voluntary elements. Do you have evidence that what came out of Copenhagen has contributed to meeting goals 2 and 4, and what do you anticipate a similar voluntary-based agreement coming out of Paris in terms of addressing goal 2 and 4. Thank you.
Nick, perhaps you'd like to answer that.
I will try. I think we have to see Copenhagen and Cancun as coming together, because we did have an agreement in Cancun that embodied a great deal of Copenhagen. But like many people in the room, I've been at very many of these UNFCCC meetings, I think all of them since Nairobi. And what I saw of Copenhagen and Cancun, I think, was significant in answering your question. China and the United States came to Copenhagen with targets. I do not believe for emissions reductions, expressed in different ways, but important in the two biggest emitters. I don't believe they would have come with those targets if there hadn't been a pressure to have an international agreement and a shared recognition of how important the issue was. So they were significant, those Copenhagen-Cancun agreements, and through the great skill of Felipe Calderon, we got that. I think that what matters most of all is the credibility of the voluntary statements. If China embodies its international stated intentions, as it has done in its 5-year plans, I find that credible. China has a record of delivery on its 5-year plans. If the United States can describe ways that it will reduce its energy through, for example, the EPA, I would find that credible. It has a track record of delivery. The key thing is not suing in some galactic court. It is whether the countries making those commitments are credible in the ways they intend to go about delivering them. And I believe we can understand that and we can assess it. So I do believe that a voluntary agreement, if it's strong in its intentions and credible in its commitments, would be of great value in driving the investment that we need.
Yes, President Calderon.
I want to add on that, and thank you, Professor Laura Nichols Stern, to clarify this point. We used to talk about the Copenhagen Agreement, but I need to clarify that it is Cancun Agreement, but there were no agreement in Copenhagen. Both have the merits. Well, the point is, let me just share with you what happened in that process between Copenhagen and Cancun. I'm a lawyer by training, and at the beginning of my life at the My point is this. According with international law, what we are expecting from multilateralism is these binding commitments expressed in a treaty. However, coming from our experience in politics, in this era of informations and global era, most of the mandatory of the binding commitments at the end of the day are voluntary commitments. But anyone could refuse the treaty at any time without consequences. And that happened with some countries in the Kyoto Protocol. On the contrary, any unilateral commitment is becoming a mandatory commitment because the global pressure coming from public opinion is in such a way important for some countries that is the key relevant variable. And that could be the case of China, for instance. Yes, under the Kyoto Protocol, the big issue after Kyoto Protocol is how can we involve big emitters, even being developing countries, in this global commitment of emission reductions. For me, for instance, and for my fellow members of the government, probably we need some kind of Annex 2 and Annex 3 in Kyoto Protocol. We cannot talk anymore about Annex 1 and non-Annex 1 because developing countries are so different. I believe that there are a lot of very poor countries that really need the support of the most developed economies. But there are other developing economies that they still need support, but they can provide some kind of commitments and personal or individual responsibility. And finally, the news that Amanda was talking a few minutes ago about the Wall Street Journal, China banned coal, at least the most ashen coal, something like that. We need to clarify that. But the point is, these kind of actions in China started at global level in such kind of agreement, unilateral and very difficult to clarify and exactly not mandatory in our traditional diplomatic terms, but it's working. Mm-hmm. And under the commitment of Cancun, we got more commitments, twice commitments in carbon emission reductions than Kyoto Protocol in terms of tons of carbon. So we need to find a way in which all the countries, according with their own circumstances, could provide some kind of political willingness. And that is politics, as Tom is very unpredictable, but Tom was saying, but very important as well.
And Pakuru, I know you've got a voice on this as well.
Well, I would like to mention about the voluntary commitment that was made by Indonesia between Bali and Copenhagen, 2009. The president makes a commitment of reducing emissions by 26% because it matters for Indonesia, and also offering 41% if that matters for the world. And that is a voluntary commitment that was done, and is now creating, with the support of Norway as the first entry into this, the world really are equally concerned with this $1 billion commitment, pay for performance kind of things. And then we are getting into that very seriously. So voluntary commitment is actually becoming a mandatory commitment within the country, and that draw the interest and the support of the likes of Norway, the likes of Unilever's commitment in terms of providing support for our smallholders, and the commitment and the support from WRI, for instance, with the technology, so that we'll be able to see what is going on deforestation in a way that is very clear, going beyond what is possible before because of the cloud situation of Indonesia. So actually, a voluntary commitment from a country can draw a lot of support and also pressure to make that voluntary commitment something that is mandatory when it comes to implementation.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir, let's take another question.
Ilmi Granov, I lead the Green Growth Team at the Overseas Development Institute, and we're, first of all, really grateful to be a new partner in the new climate economy team going forward as part of the engagement process, so I just wanted to thank the commissioners for having us join. I have a question. This is non-exclusively to Mr. Holliday and Mr. Calderon, so anyone else feel free to answer. I see the NZE report as making an empirical story of hope around the aggregate economic benefit of climate action. And it makes the case very clear that the benefit is there and that it is entirely measurable economically. We don't have to look beyond conventional measures of economic benefit to make the case. But any story of transition creates winners and losers. And capital invested is a vested interest. And my question is around, the other thing we know is that vested interests tend to shout louder than new and potential opportunities and sectors. What, if any, is the message of how we address these new winners and losers in the process of transition?
So a great question. I think you addressed it very directly, very upfront. I think the unique thing about this transition that other transitions haven't seen is innovation. Innovation here has not come as fast. I think it can help with those people that have those assets in place. The big difference here, if you're a software entrepreneur, you give me $1 million to work with, that's a lot of money. Here you need $100 million. So our systems have not adjusted and found ways, as Tom was describing, yet to take the risk and get it manageable for those existing players or the new players. I spent my career with a company called DuPont, and if they hadn't constantly made those transitions over the years, it wouldn't still be around today. And so I would talk to every one of those with those vested interests and say, where is the opportunity for you to use your expertise to take it to the next level?
Yes. Well, I agree with you in the sense that the report provides quite important signals that foster economic growth. And I will go back to that. But we need to design some kind of fair transition. And the best thing we can do is to provide clear signals to the market so any investor could adapt according with the prices, according with the signals of the market. And what we are looking right now today, even in those investment that have been made, a lot of companies are hedging their investment, even today, hedging between great investment and green investment. And that kind of hedging behavior is increasing the cost of financing the right part of development. So if we provide right now the clear signals to the market, we are, in some sense, alleviating a lot of companies that could go straight forward to green investment from now. Even though all those companies you are talking, now they realize the big risk, if you want, the regulatory risk to be captured in a lot of stranded assets investment. So if we provide clear signals to the market could design the fair transition we need, and we maybe can design some kind of mechanism in order to, I don't want to talk about compensate, but we need to think different realities. And second is what Chad has already said, thinking, for instance, in natural gas. Is natural gas a fossil fuel? Yes, it is. However, natural gas could be a transitional fuel to a new era in terms of energy. Why? Because natural gas is by far cleaner than coal, and if we decide and we are recommended to phase out coal, probably one of the most important instruments we have is to use this revolution in shale gas and here in North America and Mexico, by the way, in which we can have the time to jump into the new era in this transitional phase. And a lot of assets regarding with these fossil fuels could be usable. Finally, we need to remind, as you mentioned it, the elements that could provoke, I don't want to say by now, more growth, but we can say equal and better growth in our proposal. First, investment. Again, we will invest $90 trillion in 15 years. Let's do it in the right way. In the low-carbon economy, in infrastructure. Second, innovation. If we provide to the market the right signals, for instance, carbon tax or other regimes similar and phasing out fossil fuel subsidies on fossil fuels, we can provoke a massive innovation, which is the key issue for economic growth in history. Since millenniums, innovation is the key issue for growth. and we can provoke innovation. Renewable energy was provoked by the measures taken in Europe 20 years ago. With innovation, we will increase the productivity of the economy. Why our economies are passing such a difficult moment in Europe or in Japan or even China is declining, or Brazil is in recession. We need to increase the productivity of the economy. Always we are thinking about labor productivity or capital productivity. It's time to think in natural resources productivity, and the report will foster the natural resources productivity and therefore will foster the economic growth with better growth. So economic growth and tackling climate change.
And that's the kind of passion we need. We've almost come to the end of the proceedings, so I think we might have time for just one more question. From you, sir, is that correct?
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm the ambassador of Norway. Good to be here. And congratulations on the launching of the report. I think it's been an extremely inspiring event. I think we learned a lot. And I think around the globe, they're also happening, launching other places in Oslo with the Prime Minister Stoltenberg, as you just mentioned, happening just now at the same time. But I just wanted to highlight two things. One is that the seven commissioning countries, the foreign minister of those countries, are now sending off the letter to all the states of the UN and emphasizing what you have emphasized as well, the need for political action. As you all have agreed upon, what we need now is political action. The second is, as you have highlighted as well, is the interaction between the fight against poverty and, of course, the fight against climate change. We have been mentioning China, we have been mentioning Africa south of the Sahara, but I would also like to just ask one question, and that is India. We know that in India, 50% of the energy is from coal. What are the prospects now for a change also in India? We had great expectations, I think, when it came to this issue, with Modi being elected as Prime Minister. But first of all, thank you, and let's continue your good work.
I'm not Indian, but I've been working in India for 40 years, following one village in Moradabad district of UP and watching it change through those 40 years, and I've been closely involved in public policy making. When Prime Minister Modi took office, he committed by 2019 to using solar power to bring energy to 400 million households without energy. Notice he said 2019. That's within the five-year term of his office. It's a very politically structured commitment to do that. The Ministry of Environment and Forests has been changed to the Ministry of Environment, Forests and Climate Change. Now, that's nomenclature. You know, it's not action, but it's an indication. India has been much influenced by the crash in the price of the cost of solar energy, and it's becoming more and more a part of the plan. So I think India is changing. At the same time, they are making very clear that we emit about 2 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year per capita, and you in Europe emit about 12, and you in the United States emit about 20. So please don't lecture us. Sometimes the please is dropped. Don't lecture us, and you can see why they might take that position. But India is changing on this issue, and India is changing because they see the dangers of climate change, and they see the opportunities in poverty reduction and inclusion as a result of the changing prices of these technologies.
Thank you. So it's been a very valuable and informative discussion today, but unfortunately we have come to the end of our allotted time. So President Calderon and Lord Nicholas, if perhaps you can just give the final closing remarks before we say goodbye.
Can I pass it? Absolutely.
You can pass it to anyone you like.
Well, look, I think the story that we hope... The room walks away with, the world walks away with, is very much the story that President Calderon described. We've had, you know, in a sense, 100 years in which the world has focused heavily on different forms of productivity, but particularly labor productivity and capital productivity. And now we have an opportunity to focus on another source of productivity that has been underexploited, and that is resource productivity and the broader sense of it as natural resource productivity. And there's a huge, huge potential for the world. In a sense, I think a lot of the dialogue has been, the choice between climate and growth or trade-offs. And it creates a frame which is in some sense negative, not only that you choose, but that you have to be for or against something. This report lays out, I think, very clearly a positive story for the world economy, but it's a story that is geared to expanding degrees of freedom. When we think about cities and mobility, the question of cars, we're not thinking about being negative to cars. We're thinking about expanding choices for mobility, right? Making more opportunities available. When we think about energy, while we do also find ourselves saying that we need to phase out coal, and we believe that, we're excited about the fact that there are expanding options and expanding degrees of freedom on the way in which energy can be produced and consumed. When we think about land use, it's the same. How do we expand opportunities and the degrees of freedom and the choices that are available for decision makers, not just the high and lofty decision makers, but right down to farmers and smallholders and individual businesses and households across the world economy? That's the message of our report.
Yes, we hope the report makes a true difference. And Nick, final words to you.
Thank you very much, Mandy, and thank you very much for leading the discussion in such a productive way. Thank you. I want to make two points. That this last decade has seen the risks of doing nothing intensify as we've built up the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, as we've invested more in the high carbon economy. The emissions have gone up at the same time as the science is telling us that the risks are still bigger. Mm-hmm. So the dangers have intensified through our inaction in many ways. On the other hand, in the last 10 years, the change in the technology is quite remarkable. Who would have believed when we published the Stern Review, we didn't, that General Motors would be making electric cars. It is quite phenomenal how technology across an enormous front, as we've heard today, has changed and is changing. And I agree with Chad and Jeremy, with the emphasis on more frontiers are there, and energy efficiency is an enormous frontier. So at the same time as the risks intensifying, the opportunities have changed enormously. And that has brought us to this critical point where we have to decide. If we dither for another 15 years, we're in deep trouble. But we've also seen that the opportunities are such that we can, in those 15 years, lay the foundation for an extraordinarily strong and attractive story of growth and poverty reduction, and ones that's sustainable. That's the story of the report. It does need the political will, but I think the story itself is, I hope, a contribution to changing the political will.
Very well said, sir. A window of opportunity that we need to seize. On that note, I would like to thank very much all of our panelists here today. Thank you, Chad. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Pakaru. Thank you, President Calderon. And thank you very much, Jeremy, as well. And thank you, all of you, for joining us today. Have a great day.